You are listening to the Dan Patrick Show on Fox Sports Radio.
I did talk to Chris Mannix, the senior NBA writer from Sports Illustrated. I talked to him prior to the start of the show and recorded an interview with him. So we don't address what just happened with Kawhi or Chris Paul. But I started out asking him about some of the coaching decisions made last night by the Milwaukee Bucks. Here's Chris Mannix.
No, you're right. This was, I think, unequivocally one of the worst losses in Bucks franchise history when you factor in the stakes and the team they were playing against and the fact that at halftime they had a 16-point lead. Now, Mike Budenholzer has many critics out there. There are have been many that have suggested he should have been replaced after last season and the way they played in the bubble. So if you were a critic of Mike Budenholzer, it was a feeding frenzy last night. I mean, to not attack James Harden on every possession. I mean, you could see him walking out there, Dan. There was a noticeable limp in his step. He was not going to be able to stay in front. His defensive philosophy in this game was to back up as much as he could and force guys like Jrue Holiday to take mid-range jump shots. To not attack him was just bizarre. And on the other end of the floor, like, to not take the ball out of Kevin Durant's hands, it's not a you know, genius coaching philosophy to do that, like to play like that. You saw a couple of days ago, the LA Clippers made a decision to send double teams at Donovan Mitchell and take the ball out of his hand. Going back even further, when James Harden was a Houston Rocket, we saw defenses load up on him, force the ball out of his hands, or force him into extremely difficult shots. The Bucks philosophy seemed to be like, let PJ Tucker defend him or to foul him. And there were, I don't know how many possessions Giannis guarded him, but this is one of the top defensive players in the NBA, allegedly. Why wasn't he getting more turns on Kevin Durant? I mean, I wasn't quite yelling at the TV. I was verbally yelling through Twitter. But I had the same thought process that the coaching decisions made by Mike Budenholzer were just shocking.
And then there was another one where Giannis didn't want to take it to the hoop late. He was guarded by James Harden, and he shot a fadeaway on James Harden. He didn't want to take it to the hoop, possibly get fouled and go to the free throw line.
That goes in the Giannis Hall of Shame, if you will. I mean, a couple things on this, Dan. Like, Giannis is a two-time MVP. He is a great offensive player. Did the Nets send one double team at him during the course of that game? I saw one situation that it was actually the situation where Giannis faded away, where the Nets started to double team and then Harden waved off the defender. You've got James Harden, who on his best day is probably an average defender. And he was not on his best day in this one, is waving off a double team. So against a two-time MVP, who's got like 6 inches and 50 pounds on him, he could defend him one-on-one. And Harden and Giannis's response is to fade away in that situation. The decision-making by Giannis was just wild. I mean, when he had Harden at the top of the key, he should have gone at him. I think he got gun-shy towards the end of the game about drawing offensive fouls. When he had Harden in the low post, you have to attack him, bully him, get to the rim, and yes, get to the free throw line if that's what it comes down to. And then at the very end, to drop a pass in your breadbasket that could have given the opportunity to tie the game. I mean, this was one of the worst games we've seen Giannis play in his career.
I just wonder how they respond going back home in game six, because it's going to be one or the other. It's going to be, we got resolve, we got backbone, there's going to be a game seven, or it's going to be, you know, our heads are hanging low here. What do you expect in game six in this series?
Well, they play a lot better at home, and they always have historically during the Giannis era. So I expect them to come out with some energy. The question is, can they build a big enough lead so that in the fourth quarter, they're not just going mano-a-mano with Kevin Durant, which is not going to work for them in that particular situation. But in a way, Dan, I look at this game six for Giannis in kind of the same way I look at game six of the 2012 Eastern Conference Finals for LeBron James. Not putting LeBron and Giannis in the same company, but up until that point, LeBron had not won a championship. He had been to two finals. The Celtics were his nemesis. And going into game six, LeBron and the Miami Super Friends were down 3-2. LeBron came out in game six, had one of the best games of his career up until that point to beat Boston on the Celtics home floor. This is a different type of situation. But I kind of see it through that same lens where Giannis, this is his moment. This is his chance to either show he's one of the best players in the game or to prove the critics of him right that he can't be a number one on a championship team.
And if Milwaukee doesn't get out of this round, there's going to be changes there.
The only change you can make, though, is Mike Budenholzer.
Yeah.
And I would firmly believe that would be the case. I mean, they're locked in on this roster. They made that holiday deal at last offseason, and that cost them most of their draft capital moving forward. They signed Holiday to a max contract. It's Giannis, Holiday, Middleton. You know, Dante DiVincenzo being out certainly hurts them, but we can't put this series on that. The Nets have far more substantial injuries that they're dealing with. But this is it. Like, this is their group. I mean, the Bucks are lucky that they've got Giannis signed to that long-term extension, but I would not expect Mike Budenholzer to survive a second-round defeat.
Yeah, crazy. We're talking to Chris Mannix, the Sports Illustrated NBA senior writer. Hawks 76ers tonight, Game 5. What do you expect?
You know, I like Philadelphia in this one. I mean, Joel Embiid was brutally bad in the second half of Game 4, 0 for 12, missed that bunny. And clearly, Dan, you can tell that knee is bothering him. Like, you watch that last play, that last Philadelphia possession, excellent play call by Doc Rivers, excellent execution by almost everybody, and then Embiid gets it. And because he can't explode off that knee, he just muffs a layup at the very end that winds up costing them the game. I do expect being back at home is going to give Philadelphia a bounce. Ben Simmons did not play well in that Game 4. Embiid, of course, I think will play a little bit better on his home floor as well. I thought the Sixers' perimeter defense overall was pretty good against Atlanta. So I think Philadelphia wins this Game 6. But, man, that Game 4, they blew a really big opportunity to potentially get Embiid 3 or 4 extra days rest going into a conference finals. That could wind up costing this team, if not this series, in subsequent series moving forward.
Are you all in on the Clippers now?
No. I'm not. No. The Clippers, to me, they still look, when they flip a switch, and I hate using that phrase because it's such a cliche, but like they do. They flip a switch and they play great. They did it in games 3 and 4 against Dallas. They did it in games 3 and 4 against Utah. I just don't know what to expect from them in a Game 5. Like, would it surprise me if Utah went out, Mike Conley came back, and they won by, I don't know, 15 points? No. Like, the Clippers are just too wildly unpredictable. I mean, if you're telling me Paul George is going to play exactly like that in Game 5, sure, all in on the Clippers, but he's unpredictable. The front court, the small lineup, Marcus Morris is unpredictable. I think the Clippers did an unbelievable job of getting back into the series in those two games, but I'm still not buying the LA Clippers.
Thank you, Chris.
You got it, Dan.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Dan Patrick Show weekdays at 9 a.m. Eastern, 6 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
John Wertheim has the book, The Summer of 1984 and the 90 Days That Changed Sports and Culture Forever, now available online wherever books are sold. John, I'm 100 pages in, no, a little over 100 pages in. I got to the point where you mentioned me when I was at CNN, and I was okay with it, but, you know, you threw in the word shticky, and I don't know if that's in a good way or bad way, John. Can you help? Because it's ruined. It's basically ruined my night last night.
Oh, come on! It was in the best possible sense. The NBA has a new commissioner, a guy named David Stern, in 1984, and he's an internal candidate and is so little known that an ascending broadcast personality for
you didn't
CNN.
Say ascending broadcaster.
Dashingly handsome.
You didn't even say that.
We'll tell the story. So you had a, it was fun. You asked people on the street if they knew Isaac Stern, Daniel Stern, or David Stern, I believe. But
Howard,
I think
Stern.
The real point is, like, yeah, Howard Stern. But I think the real point is people forget that David Stern was not this celebrated commissioner when he took over the job in 84. And, this little-known lawyer quickly got to work.
There's a great quote in here, and it's early in the book. It says, "History doesn't send out invitations in advance." Apparently somebody else is calling John right now. You know, he works for 60 Minutes. So, wait, are you on assignment right now, John?
You say that jokingly. Forgive that. Crazy day.
You have history doesn't send out invitations in advance. I love that line. And, you know, going back and reading all the things that happened in 1984, I don't know if there was a point where you go, there is enough to be able to write a book about this. Like, was there a certain number that you were looking at to go, if I get to that, then I can write this book?
Once we had eight. No, I mean, the real challenge, like, so all this stuff happens in 84, right? You've got the ascent of Jordan, and he's sort of the spine of the book. Imagine you're David Stern, and you've got bird magic in a game seven. And then a few days after that, you come to New York for your first draft, and oh, right, it's Sam Bowie, Olajuwon, Jordan Barkley, and among your top five picks. But I mean, so all the stuff happens, as you say, and it's Gretzky wins his first cup, and you've got the profitable Olympics and Karate Kid. And the real mystery to me was sort of why. Was it just coincidence, or was there something that really was going on in the culture that was elevating sports and making it such a big deal in this compressed period of time?
And the importance that music played in writing this book, because you do mention there's Springsteen and Prince on the cover. MTV was just getting big at that moment. So that intersection, how did you try to weave that in?
What cable and ESPN was to sports that summer, which was sort of like, holy cow, we've got this force and we can get it anytime we want. And it's a new experience. And by the way, there's going to be some real money here. It was really similar to what MTV did to music. And, you know, this was just as we went from like, oh, there's a game of the week to, wow, I can get this anytime I want. 24/7, you could not only listen to the artists that you loved on the radio, but you could see these little mini movies that went with all the songs.
Is there a moment that stood out because it's something that you didn't realize in the moment, or maybe you'd forgotten about it?
That's a good question. I mean, I think some of it was just how big an impact Jordan had. As much as we know about Jordan, you know, we all know the six rings. We can all do our sort of the last dance recitation. But I think people don't realize how much he changed the model and the leverage of talent and the athlete. And this 550 grand, whatever it was, the Bulls are paying me, that's nice, but I can make a lot more money from a lot of different places. That hadn't really happened before him. The other one, I'm sure you probably heard this story, but I didn't realize this whole victory tour, you know, Michael Jackson, most popular man on the planet. His parents say this Thriller album's great, but you got to make us rich. You got to make your brothers rich. They do a victory tour. Don King somehow manages to insinuate himself as the promoter, but the tour is bankrolled by the Sullivan family. They collateralize Sullivan Stadium. The tour is an absolute fiasco. The brothers hate each other. Michael's bringing along Emmanuel Lewis and Brooke Shields, and the brothers don't talk to him. And it loses so much money that the Sullivan family sell the team. Through a number of twists, it ends up with this gentleman named Bob Kraft. And you could make a credible case, I think, the Patriots dynasty doesn't happen if Michael Jackson doesn't do the stupid victory tour.
There's so many things that are connected here. I love the Martina Navratilova stuff because people forget how brave she was when she defected. And really, she was part of the modern athlete. Her and Jordan, at about that same time, Mike had hired Tim Grover to be his trainer. It was okay to lift weights. Martina said it's okay to look like this, to be in shape. And I thought that those were very interesting parallels between those two.
An esteemed weekly sports publication that will go unnamed made fun of Martina. You know, she used a supercomputer to check on the statistical tendencies of her opponents. Now we would call that analytics. And, you know, she had, I think the quote was like, she had vines of gnarled veins crawling up her arms. Well, gee, she got herself in shape to play a sport? That's a crazy thought. And she had an entourage of people that acted as a support team. She was way ahead of her time. And it wasn't just that she didn't get credit for it. She was mocked. This was like something you made fun of her for using a supercomputer. And in 1984, she was basically playing Moneyball with tennis.
He's John Wertheim, the Sports Illustrated executive editor and, of course, the author of Glory Days. You can see him on 60 Minutes. It's the summer of 1984, the 90 days that changed sports and culture forever. Now available online wherever books are sold. I was in the early stages of my career, of course, an ascending career, but I was there to cover the USFL, and I went to those press conferences at Trump Tower where you'd have the big waterfall and the escalator. And, you know, if it was Doug Flutie or Herschel Walker, I covered the USFL trial. Like, these are all these bring, like, I get twitch. I start to twitch a little bit when I think back to that. What did you find out about Trump then that maybe would have braced you for or us that this is who Trump is now?
That is a great way to put it. Give him this. He's committed to the role. I mean, you mentioned press conference and escalators and Trump Tower, and be sure to use that playbook again. No, I mean, you go back, and part of that, Jeff Perlman wrote a great book about Trump and the USFL, and there were some great stories from 84 is sort of when he became this national figure. And you read those stories, and it's amazing to compare that to, you know, Trump plays fast and loose with the truth, but he sure has a certain magnetism. There was a story that Willie Geist's dad wrote an article, and it said something like, you know, riding around with Donald Trump is like, you know, riding around Manhattan with a motorcycle with no windshield. You get a lot of bugs in your teeth, but it sure is fun. And basically, he is what he is. And the same sort of the same playbook he used with the USFL, the same way, there was a lot of vagueness. There was a lot of media. I mean, Charlie Steiner, who is the sort of the voice of the Generals, tells the story. He said the players love Trump because after the game, he'd go to the locker room and he'd say, you know, everyone, it's Trump, T-R-U-M-P, same as the building. And he would hold the press conferences and the players would say, fine, I'm leaving. I'm going out to dinner. You can hear and do the press conference. But it's a lot of the same MO in 1984 that it would be 32 years later.
How close do you think the USFL or some of these teams came to being absorbed by the NFL?
That's a great question, because I mean, the one thing that became clear to me researching this book is we cannot underestimate the force, and you know this better than anyone, the force that is cable television. And this was right around the time that these networks were realizing you could charge the cable system the subscriber fee and totally change the economics. And by the way, these networks all need programming. And if Trump, I mean, I think single-handedly, Trump did to the USFL, like, you know, what Isaiah Thomas did for the CBA in basketball. I mean, Trump just wrecked this league. If they had hung around and gotten a cable TV deal, whether it would have been a competing league or whether it would have had to have been absorbed ABA, NBA style, the USFL, had they hung out a couple more years, I think they really could have made it.
What stood out at the 84 Olympics?
Michael Jordan. No, I think what stood out was you had this boycott, and everyone thought that this was the death of the Olympics, right? Yeah, you had terrorism in Munich, and Montreal was a financial disaster, and a boycott in 80, and the Soviets aren't going to compete in 84, and it didn't matter. And for a variety of reasons, Peter Ueberroth comes in for a lot of credit in this book. There was no terrorism. There was no drama. We all watched this. It was a slow summer. We all got Big Macs and fries when Americans won medals. It was the highest, you know, the most viewed program in American TV history at the time. Peter Ueberroth, you know, we all love Mary Lou Retton and Carl Lewis and Jordan and Knight, who I see to your left. But Peter Ueberroth was the MVP of those Olympics.
The stuff with Jordan's interesting, going back to where he wanted to stay for his senior year at North Carolina. And it almost felt like Dean said, hey, you're going to the NBA. And the fact that Bob Knight, it didn't take long for him to realize that this is the greatest basketball player talent-wise he had ever seen, trying to convince the Blazers to take Michael Jordan. And they said, you know, hey, we got Clyde Drexler and Jim Paxson. We have no room for Michael Jordan. Those were great stories there. Great nuggets.
Knight's quote to Stu Inman, the GM of the Blazers, who was a friend of his. And you're right. The guy said, hey, we don't need Jordan. We already got a swing man. We got this Drexler guy. We have, you know, ironically enough, we have Jim Paxson. And Knight's quote was, trust me, take Jordan, play him at center if you have to. You don't want to miss on this kid. for whatever his flaws were, give Bob Knight credit for that one.
Toughest interview to get for the book was who?
The interview that never happened, which was Jordan. He's tough. And, you know, I was saying this the other day. You go back and you look at 1984. He is so cool, and he's funny, and he's a prankster. And, you know, I mean, I certainly understand how fame can wear you down. But to me, it's a bit of a pity that he's been a little reclusive, because he was great as a 20-year-old, great as a 21-year-old. And I think that the fame monster sort of beat him up. But no, people were great for this book. And I think it's because David Stern was a real resource. And he was basically saying, everyone remembers it, right? Everyone knows Magic and Bird, and people have these memories, but it's far enough away so I don't have to worry about, you know, saying something I shouldn't. So people were great when I got them, but Jordan, full disclosure, Jordan declined my outreach.
Well, and I went through this firsthand. I was very lucky to do those interviews after he was winning championships, but he was going to be the number one athlete, the sports century number one athlete. And we couldn't get him for an interview. And we were chasing Michael Jordan down to, he was going to be the number one athlete. And then we like, Mike, you're going to be the number one athlete. Everybody else has done an interview here. And we eventually got him. I had to go to New York last minute to his hotel, set it up. He came in from golfing and he sat down, and I don't know how long he went, and I don't even know how good it was, but we would have looked really bad with the number one athlete, and he wouldn't sit down. But I just think he gets to that point where, what does he need to answer anymore? But if you had one question, you knew you were going to get an honest answer from Michael Jordan, what would you have asked?
I wondered whether in 1984, he had a sense of where this was going. He was supremely confident. He knew about, he understood the business right away. I mean, David Falk did not have to convince him that he needed his own signature shoe. I think Michael Jordan, for as much as we talk about him, I don't think he's gotten enough credit for really changing the balance of power in terms of athlete and management. And I wonder in 1984, if he was already onto this. And I think, you know, I mean, you and I know this, right? Some athletes are cut out for this, and some athletes, they are what they do. Maybe they're just not that interesting. Maybe they've been burned by the media. I mean, Michael Jordan, go back and read about, you know, his quotes and the way he conducted himself. You know, his decision, we've never experienced a fraction of his fame. I certainly haven't. But this guy has Peyton Manning's sense of humor and Barkley's instincts. I mean, at age 20, at age 21, he was fantastic as a character. So it's a bit of a pity to me that he's so reclusive now, because he had it in him to be this figure who was a lot more prominent in the call. I mean, his call, his decision, I hope he, you know, enjoys the golf, but I do think he had it in him to be Peyton Manning or Barkley if he wanted to.
Yeah, but I look back differently on Jordan. His mom made him go to Portland and meet with Nike. You had the two different agents who were going to represent him. They kind of said, you get Sam Perkins and you get Michael Jordan. Sonny Vaccaro is the one who deserves the credit for Michael Jordan being that, because Sonny said, give him all the money. Let's do a shoe based on a player. That was unheard of, because you had Magic and Larry were doing Converse. And as you point out in the book, Converse didn't really invest in these individuals. They just basically gave you a check. Sonny Vaccaro had the wisdom to say, we're going to create a shoe for Michael Jordan. That's the genius there. Mike just went along for the ride.
Success has many fathers. You know, George Raveling played a role. I mean, I think some of this too, you know, David Falk is this tennis agent, and he has this boss, Donald Dell, who's, and Falk is really kind of, you know, it's like entourage. I mean, you know, David Falk is really trying to make a name for himself, and he seizes on Jordan and says, this guy is charismatic. He's playing in a big media market. He understands intuitively what I'm trying to do. So, yeah, I mean, I think Sonny gets credit. I think Raveling gets credit. I think Falk gets credit. But I think Jordan got it. And Jordan understood that there was a lot more money on the table for an athlete than what his rookie contract with the Bulls was going to pay him. And Jordan really, you know, Jordan leaned into the role, right? I mean, he did the shoots and the limos, and he did the Mars Blackman. And Jordan understood intuitively that he wasn't going to make nearly as much money from the Bulls as he should have, but there were these other revenue sources. And I think this is a real, you know, we talk about sort of activism and the, you know, card 68 Olympics and even more recently Kaepernick. But I think Jordan understanding commerce is one of these pivot points in sports history that we're going to be talking about.
I think that's true with Jordan, and Martina understanding that speak up, use your voice. Mm-hmm. I think those were the two things that stood out so much with the book so far that I've read. And you did a great job. It's a great read, John. And I can't wait for the sequel, 1985. That I'm sure you're working on that right now, right?
I'm trying to think. What we get to? We get Lakers and Celtics again. We got that going for us, but I'm not sure it'll be quite as pivotal. No, I appreciate it.
There's the Patrick Ewing. There's lottery. The Chicago Bears. Come on, John, do some research here.
Yeah, where's my agent? No, you're right. We got frozen frozen envelopes. We're on it. Kansas City Royals. No, this is no, but see, I appreciate it, and I like that you came across that. You came across the anecdote with Howard Stern and Isaac Stern, but seriously, I mean, you caught this cable wave, and cable TV, it's propping up sports, and it's made figures like Dan Patrick, and I think it's going to be interesting where we go from here, because cable's really the story of sports in the last 35 years.
John, thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend, and we appreciate your time.
Anytime. Thanks, Dan.
That's John Wertheim.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
Hey, this is Jason McIntyre. Join me every weekday morning on my podcast, Straight Fire with Jason McIntyre. This isn't your typical sports pod pushing the same tired narratives down your throat every day. Straight Fire gives you honest opinions on all the biggest sports headlines, accurate stats to help you win big at the sportsbook, and all the best guests. Do yourself a favor and listen to Straight Fire with Jason McIntyre on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Nick Wright, First Things First co-host. He was there for the game last night. Bucks Nets game 5 at Barclays as the series now shifts to Milwaukee for game 6. And I have no idea what to expect from the Bucks. Well, both teams going into game 6, but let's reflect on game 5. Do you want to start with the obvious with Kevin Durant, or do you want to start with the Milwaukee Bucks game plan, Nick?
Let's start with the good. Let's start with the obvious and Kevin Durant. Do me a favor, Dan. At the end of this, leave 30 seconds because I have a question for you at the very, very end.
But okay.
We'll start with Durant. It's not only unquestionably the finest game of his career, and I don't know what the most impressive part is. I think it's the 48 minutes. Playing 48 out of 48, the only guy in this era that we've been able to rely on doing that is LeBron, and his body is just historically built differently. Like, I didn't think Durant could do that. He did it without ever resting at any moment. And when you look at the greatest wings of all time, Dan, LeBron, Michael, Kobe, and Bird, I am hard-pressed to find a playoff game that Bird or Kobe had that tops this one. Bird had 37-9-9 in a game 7 to beat the Pistons in 87. He had an unbelievable game 7 against the Knicks. Kobe had a 50-point game and a loss when he was undermanned the way Durant is to the Suns that year in 06 when they lost in 7. This is one of the finest playoff games a wing has played in NBA history. And it's the greatest game I've ever been in person for. And I don't think any of that is prisoner of the moment stuff. You obviously watched Bird live. I can't think of a time he was better than this.
Well, and I know you're talking about wing players, because I think what Magic did in the NBA Finals his rookie year when he played
better.
Center.
Absolutely.
You know, I could make a case for Clyde Frazier game 7 NBA Finals against the Lakers when he went 36 and 19 assists.
17 or something,
Yeah, but what we saw with that team with no supporting cast around him, and it's one of those, that this is why I thought Steph Curry was the MVP this year. Everybody in the building knew that Steph was going to shoot, but he still led the league in scoring, and he was wonderful this year. Everybody in the building last night knew Kevin Durant was the option for this team, and somehow, some way, the Milwaukee Bucks thought, let's just put one player on him.
Let's stay on that for a second, because before we get to the Bucks, ridiculous game plan on both sides of the ball, just infuriating. What you touched on there
it's in an odd way, Durant's brilliance last night is why fans were so mad at him for Golden State and then got mad at him all over again when they got Harden. Because what is your favorite Steph Curry season? Maybe this one. What are some of your favorite LeBron James moments in series? The 2015 finals, when he was absolutely outgunned. Maybe the greatest LeBron game ever. Game one of the 2018 finals, where you want to watch John McClane in Die Hard against 12 terrorists. You don't want to watch three John McClanes against two terrorists. And so there is a part as a sports fan where you almost, you don't need to see it all the time, but you want to see the best in the world when they when the odds are totally stacked against them. And for Durant, aside from one playoff series against the Grizzlies after Russ got his knee blown or torn up by Patrick Beverley, he's always had an MVP alongside him in every playoff series he's played in. One with Golden State, Steph wasn't there, but Clay was. And so we never got to see this from Durant. I think people wanted to see it, even if that's unfair to him. Like, does that make sense? Like,
yeah.
This is what we wanted to see, even if it's not sustainable for a career. You wanted to see it for maybe a season like we got to see from Steph this year.
Yeah, I agree. It's a great point. We're talking to Nick Wright, First Things First co-host on Fox Sports 1. I yelled at the TV last night, Nick. It's been a while since I've yelled at the TV, and I'm by myself. And I'm just wondering that at some point, does somebody on Milwaukee's bench tell Mike Budenholzer, how about we run another guy at Durant? How about we have him pick up his dribble? How about we double team him? If Danny Green's going to beat us, great. Harden's not going to beat us. Let's you know, I like our chances over here than I do with this. But you have one guy on him. You let him go right. You let him do what he wants to do. He was incredible. But I got to get the ball out of the best player's hands, Nick.
It was offensive coaching. You'd have done better. Whoopi Goldberg, just from filming Eddie, would have done better. Your older new listeners will like that. The drunk teenager, and I know teenagers aren't supposed to drink, but I'm pretty sure he's a teenager and I'm pretty sure he was drunk, sitting behind me in the stands would have done better. A couple things. One is, our statistician, a guy named Dustin Wade, I want to give him credit. He tracked the game by hand at 3 this morning so I could have this info and now I'll share it with your audience. Kevin Durant was double-teamed, true double-teamed, 0 times all game. They sent a second guy at Durant so little, he took 0 jump shots with a help defender on him. Every time they sent a help defender on him, he made the pass. And they defended it as if Kyrie were out there and Harden was full strength. And it's like, we can't double him. Yes, you can. You can double him. And if Jeff Green goes for 47 instead of 27, then you lose. But I don't even think that was the worst coaching job. James Harden, what's the old line, Dan? A one-legged man in an ass-kicking contest? James Harden was a one-legged man in Game 5 of the playoffs. They didn't make him defend anybody.
I know.
How do you not just say, hey, he can't move at all. Like, obviously, he's not a great defender when he's healthy. I thought in the first half, honestly, and this is me giving the Bucks coaching staff too much credit, I thought they knew that if they went at Harden, that Nash would take Harden out. And they were having such an easy way of it that they were like, we don't want Harden out. We know we can go to that if we need to. But they never went to it. That is the type of franchise-changing loss. You're up 17 with 7 minutes left in the third quarter, and the other team's got one guy. And you just let him shoot flames out his eyeballs and burn your house down. It was unbelievable. Unbelievable.
And I know that if you look at the stat line, Greek Freak had a great night. But it's not how much you have. It's when you get that total. And he shot a fadeaway with James Harden on him. They didn't even double him. Harden said, I don't need a double, waved it away. And, you know, then he fumbles the ball with a turnover. He misses a free throw. Like, these are small things, and I know I'm nitpicking, but you nitpick with great players in these moments where you want them to be able to show you why they're better than everybody else. This is a 2-time MVP, and he shied away from going to the hoop because I think he was worried about shooting free throws.
Okay, you nailed that. A two-time MVP and one-time Defensive Player of the Year, and he guarded Durant on two shots last night. That ain't great. And Chuck said it. Your friend Charles Barkley, my friend Charles Barkley, said it after the game, and I think he's right, that the fadeaway, I think, is because he doesn't want to shoot free throws. And the fumble on what should have been an easy dunk, Charles said, and I'll take his word for it because he's been in this situation, not afraid of the shooting free throws, but in this situation in the game, that he said he rushed it because he was trying to go up too fast because he was afraid of getting hit. Yeah. That's not tenable. And Giannis, I almost feel like at times the way we talk about Giannis, the way we talk about some of these superstars can be toxic. I get it, and I feed into that sometimes. And I, now that I, like, for example, I see that Kawhi Leonard has, like, a real lower body, like, medical issue. I feel badly about some of my commentary from last year. But the other extreme of that is I think we're almost patronizing with some of our commentary to Giannis because everybody loves him. He's so likable. He's loyal. He almost seems childlike, like, at times. And so we don't hold him nearly to the standard we hold anyone else in the league that has half of his accomplishments, which is you got to be better. You got to find a way to hold on to the lead and hold on to the ball. And he couldn't do either last night. And now the entire Bucks franchise is on the brink, not just the season.
It's been a busy day this morning. You got Stan Van Gundy's out. Scott Brooks is now out with the Wizards. And you got Kawhi out game five tonight. And Chris Paul is in COVID protocol. I mean, this is, I've said this the last couple of days, the healthiest team is going to win the NBA championship, it feels like. It's just of the injuries, we're going to look back on these playoffs, and it'll be the year of the injury.
Yeah, what's amazing? I agree with you as far as the overall point, but you know what the healthiest team is? Milwaukee, and they're blowing it.
I know.
Like, they are actually the healthiest team, and they are blowing it. You've got, if Chris Paul misses a game, you're going to have nine guys who made the All-Star game this year miss a playoff game. Think about that. Nine guys.
Yeah.
And then a 10th in LeBron, who was clearly not 100%. And speaking of the injuries thing, are you nervous for KD? I am. I don't think Nash has done a great job. I know I'm in the minority on that. I didn't understand how Harden can go from out to doubtful to questionable to 46 and a half minutes.
I had a big problem with that, Nick. I worry more about Harden going 46 than I do Durant going 48, which sounds crazy considering what Durant's coming off of. But 46 for Harden, that's a whole lot of minutes.
It's a whole lot of minutes. And we talked about it on TV this morning, and my co-host Brandon Marshall said, listen, sometimes it's not the coach's choice. If a guy is, Harden's stature says, I'm going to play, he's going to play. And I buy that to a degree. But it is certainly the coach's choice how much he plays.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing when James Harden's like, coach, I'm going to give it a go, he didn't think that meant he was going to sit for 94 seconds. I understand I don't want to play Mike James either if I'm Steve Nash. I think their best point guard option is Steve Nash. And you might say, well, Nick, then the Bucks would just, torture Nash on defense. No, they wouldn't. They didn't torture Harden on defense. Nash could have suited it up, stood in the corner too. Maybe knocked down some threes. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. Can I ask you my question?
Yes, you can.
Assuming it happens,
okay.
Do you want to go to game seven? Let's do it, Dan. Come on. You and I have never hung out. You can't be that far of a drive. I don't get any comp tickets like you. I'm not fancy. I don't sit in press area. I sit amongst the people. Good, not amazing seats. Now, if you want to go and you want to pay for them, we can upgrade them. That's fine. But otherwise, let's go to a game seven, man. Come on. Make the drive. Do it, Dan. You don't have to commit right now, but promise me you'll think about it. Saturday night, my family's out of town. I'm all alone. I took my wife and daughters to the game yesterday. They all leave me tomorrow. I'm going to be sad by myself unless you come. Let's go. Let's do it, Dan.
Wait, so game seven is?
If it exists, it's Saturday night.
I am visiting my son
and
his wife.
Oh, my God. Oh my God! I don't even know that you have a son.
I do. Like I do. I have one, and he's in Charleston, South Carolina. I'm going to go visit him.
Wow! Right now, Fritzy, booking your plane ticket just so you have the alibi checked out.
No.
Wow! You'd rather go visit.
And it's worth buying a fake ticket than to go. I think with you to the game, because if you had better seats, then I could. How about McLovin? McLovin lives in Brooklyn. Yeah. He lives right by Barclays.
10-minute train ride. I'd like to sit up closer, but I could settle.
Oh, well, listen, I don't buy terrible seats. I was like 12th row behind the Nets bench last night. What I'm saying is I feel like, Dan Patrick's motto has been, if your feet ain't on the wood, it's no good. And I don't got Dan Patrick money. I got Nick Wright money.
Okay, but so are you just saying you don't want to have McLovin go with you? Just say that, Nick.
What I'm saying is I'm visiting my son in Charleston, South Carolina, McLovin. I'm sorry. Otherwise, we'd be in there.
And that is fair. It's a great excuse. I'm going to use that one day.
You should.
I'll take your ticket. God. If you're going to be in Charleston with Dan.
You know what, Nick? The next round, then we'll go to a Brooklyn game. How about that?
Oh, okay. Locked. If they make it, do you think they can win a game without Durant doing this? Like, that's the other thing. Is like, does Durant have to do this again?
I think he's gonna have to come close to it. Now Harden can't be as bad as he was, but then Danny Green is probably not gonna knock down. Same thing. He's not gonna be shooting the way he did. Probably, maybe Joe Harris comes alive. Pick up the white courtesy phone.
Do you think when Joe Harris goes in the locker room and he takes off his jersey, he's actually Kyle Korver? And it's like, hey, look, the greatest three-point shooter in NBA history until the playoffs start. And then it's tied to the backboard.
Wow.
Like, was that unfair?
Yeah, it might have been.
Am I still bitter that Korver cost LeBron that game three against Durant in 2017? Maybe. A little bitter.
I'll see you in Charleston this weekend.
Absolutely. Our sons, we're all going to force them playing golf. It'll be great.
That's Nick Wright. First things first, co-host Fox Sports 1.
Be sure to catch the live edition of the Dan Patrick Show weekdays at 9 a.m. Eastern, 6 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.